Anybody who goes to a psychiatrist ought to have their head examined. As the old Samuel Goldwyn joke goes, but what do you do when you've examined their head and you don't find anything wrong?
Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. An important diagnosis got left behind in the transition from DSM-4 to DSM-5. It was no diagnosis. Or more specifically, no diagnosis on axis 1, and the closely related no diagnosis on axis 2. When paired together, the two codes were the culmination of a difficult evaluation, because it's not easy to conclude that a person who came to see you with psychiatric symptoms doesn't actually have a mental illness. We don't know how this critical category slipped through the cracks, but if you go to the APA website, they have this update for us. In May 2018, the DSM-5 Steering Committee approved the inclusion of the category, no diagnosis or condition, and its corresponding ICD-10 code, Z03.89, is available for immediate use.
While I'm glad they put the no diagnosis category back in the book, there's still a lot of biases against using it. Makes me wonder if the omission was some kind of Freudian slip.
There you go, diagnosing everything. Even the DSM committee can't make an innocent mistake. It has to be a Freudian slip.
And this bias in our psychiatric culture goes back to Freud, whose best-selling book was The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. The title alone pushed forth the idea that everyone is a little mentally ill.
I have to say it's not like this in other medical specialties. Most neurologists are not looking to diagnose everyone with muscle spasms as being on the multiple sclerosis spectrum. And cardiologists have a whole system to rule out myocardial infarction. And when they do rule it out, they don't tell the patient that they might have had a touch of ischemia. Nope, they tell them they had benign musculoskeletal pain.
This month, we interviewed a psychiatrist who would like to see that change. Joel Paris has written a series of books that criticize the diagnostic fervor in psychiatry. He would like to see us think more critically about what mental illness is so we can recognize what it's not. In the interview, Dr. Paris talks about how to work with patients who are disappointed that they don't have the diagnosis they think explains their problems. He lists the top 5 conditions that are overdiagnosed in psychiatry, one that's underdiagnosed, and the reasons we keep making those mistakes. And on his list of overdiagnosed conditions was a surprise, borderline personality disorder.
Now that we have DBT and other effective treatments for borderline personality disorder, it's become more popular. And I'm having to tell people, no, actually, you don't have borderline personality disorder, and they're disappointed.
Dr. Paris is a specialist in borderline personality disorder. He even wrote a recent book about how borderline is increasingly misdiagnosed as bipolar 2, bipolar spectrum diagnosis, or FAD. Now, Dr. Aiken, you are a bipolar specialist, so what did you think of that book?
Actually, I started out by specializing in borderline personality disorder and drifted toward bipolar, so I have sympathies for both sides. When I read Dr. Paris's book, my reaction was that most of these misdiagnoses happen with cyclothymic disorder, which is not exactly the same as bipolar disorder. I've always thought of cyclothymic disorder as a personality disorder. You know, it's a strange thing in DSM. Both schizophrenia and the mood disorders have milder spectrum disorders that occur at a temperamental level and are seen more often in the relatives of patients with the full condition. In schizophrenia, these spectrum concepts were put in the personality disorder section, schizoid, schizotypal, and paranoid personality. But the analogous mood temperaments were placed in the mood disorder section, not the personality section, particularly dysthymic disorder, which is temperamental depression, and cyclothymic disorder, which is a temperamental version of bipolar.
So your idea is that cyclothymic disorder belongs in the personality disorder section, but that doesn't exactly make it the same as borderline.
Yes, but the two disorders do have a lot of overlap, much more, I think, than bipolar and borderline do, which in their pure forms don't really have much in common with each other. When you go back to the early drafts of DSM-3, this is when they were first sketching out the criteria that would become borderline personality in the 1970s. In those early drafts, they called it not borderline, but cycloid personality. And the criteria there read a lot like cyclothymic disorder. The patients have irregular energy levels with intense variable moods where depression predominates but is interspersed by brief periods of elation, dejection, anxiety, or impulsive anger. Fast forward 20 years, and in Marsha Linehan's textbook on DBT, she credits this early draft of cycloid personality as informing her theory of borderline. She believed that patients with borderline personality had a unique temperament, and she wrote, "The theory I present here is in many ways similar to that of cycloid personality."
But Dr. Paris did not exactly agree with you.
Well, I don't think it's a good term. And you mentioned—
You mean cyclothymic temperament? You mean cycloid?
Cycloid or cycloid. What we're talking about is emotional instability, affective dysregulation. I think that's a much better term.
So Dr. Paris agrees the borderline personality disorder arises out of a unique temperament, but he doesn't see that temperament as cyclothymic disorder. Instead, he calls it emotional instability. And this is how he describes it.
What you see in the patients, and they describe it to you, is if I get up, they'll say to you, I get upset and I blow sky high. It takes me hours to calm down. And this is not anything like hypomania in bipolar 2, you know, because I take a lot of trouble. Sometimes I'm not sure if the patient has bipolar or not. So I go to a lot of trouble to see, did you ever have a period of 4 days where you were high consistently or more? And if they do, then I start wondering, well, maybe this is one of Haga-Pakiskil's kind of cases. But the vast majority of them do not describe that. They describe it goes on for a few hours and then they sleep it off and the next day something else happens.
Dr. Paris emphasized that this emotional instability becomes particularly charged at moments of stress or conflict in close relationships. Lois Joy Kahn used the term interpersonal hypersensitivity in our 2020 interview to describe the same phenomenon, which she saw as the core problem in borderline personality disorder.
In this model of BPD as a problem of interpersonal hypersensitivity, when people with BPD are feeling really connected and secure in their relationship with somebody else, they tend to be very collaborative and appreciative of that other person, but also sensitive to looking out for cues of threat or signs of rejection or disapproval. So it's not exactly a steady place to be, but it's a collaborative place.
Dr. Aiken, did this interview change your mind?
Yes, we're getting closer to a consensus here. I think Dr. Paris's and Dr. Choi Kahn's view of emotional instability is more scientifically pure than the cyclothymic concept. Because here, they're isolating a more specific component, emotional instability, rather than a broader concept like cyclothymic disorder to explain borderline. Now, there is still some overlap there because patients with cyclothymic disorder usually have this emotionally reactive, unstable trait, but he's focusing on that trait instead of like the fluctuations of energy and sleep that also characterize cyclothymic disorder. So he's looking for the core, and I respect that. It's a lot like the new RDOC approach to diagnoses that the NIMH is promoting, where instead of looking at broad diagnostic concepts like cyclothymic disorder or major depression, they want researchers to focus on isolated symptoms or traits that stretch across diagnoses, like avoidance, disinhibition, or in this case, emotional instability. Traits like emotional instability are considered transdiagnostic because we see them in many different disorders. There are many paths to emotional instability, and while Dr. Paris nixed cyclothymic disorder as the central pathway, he also clarified that trauma is not the royal road to borderline personality disorder either.
It is not trauma. This is one of the great myths about BPD, that it's due to trauma. That's why I'm against complex PTSD, because trauma is common among in BPD patients, but it's actually less than half the cases that have a significant history of trauma.
What? I'm thinking, I mean, how many patients with borderline personality disorder have I seen who trace their problems back to childhood trauma? Dr. Paris isn't exactly disagreeing with that. He's just being more specific. In his view, it's not so much the trauma as the invalidating environment that often goes along with those traumatic childhoods that creates borderline personality.
We have a good etiological theory of borderline personality disorder, unlike many mental disorders. Marsha Linehan's theory was one of her greatest contributions. Emotional dysregulation is a heritable trait, which is then amplified by an invalidating environment. I mean, there's more to it than that. But I think the essence of borderline personality disorder is in that conceptualization. And the treatments are, in fact, based on that conceptualization, because we're all doing some version of Linehan's therapy now.
Can you put that in concrete terms? What is an invalidating environment?
Invalidating environment usually means that you grow up in a situation where your family isn't interested in your emotions. It's sometimes been called emotional neglect. Right, the patients described to me almost universally is, no, nobody was interested in my feelings. I was told to buck up, get over it, not make a big deal out of it. So the idea is that if you are unusually sensitive, some people have very thin skins, they have high neuroticism, everything bothers them, everything upsets them, they can't calm down. And that is a highly heritable trait. But if you are in an environment where there's somebody around you who says, I understand how you feel, you have every right to feel that way, let's figure out how you can get past this, you know, and calm down and think of a way to solve the problem. And then it's not so bad. And we've all done this as parents with our kids.
So it's emotional hypersensitivity and an invalidating environment, not trauma and cyclothymia, that sow the seeds of borderline personality disorder. It just happens that a lot of patients with cyclothymic disorder are emotionally hypersensitive, and a lot of patients with trauma histories grew up in invalidating environments. But you know, if we go back to Emil Kraepelin, who was one of the first to describe cyclothymic temperament, he also wrote about a more specific temperament that is probably closer to our idea of how borderline is today. He called it excitable personality. The patients display from their youth up extraordinarily great fluctuations in emotional equilibrium. They fall into outbursts of boundless fury. The coloring of mood is subject to frequent change. They shed tears without cause, give expression to thoughts of suicide, and bring forth hypochondriac complaints. In consequence of their irritability and their changing mood, their conduct of life is subject to the most multifarious incidents.
Borderline personality disorder inspires a lot of controversy, whether it's splitting in a treatment team or debates about the origins of this mercurial disorder. In some ways, that controversy is baked into the word itself. The Hungarian-American psychoanalyst Adolf Stern first used the term in 1938 to describe patients who were on the border of neurosis and psychosis. Psychoanalysis was a treatment for patients with neurotic level disorders. For example, conditions that we know of today as generalized anxiety, somatization, panic, and major depression. Patients who functioned at a psychotic level, such as schizophrenia, were considered too much out of touch with reality to tolerate the open-ended structure of psychoanalysis, which required patients to lay on a couch, stare at the ceiling, and unlock the gates to their repressed unconscious by freely associating over any thought that enters their mind. The patients that Dr. Stern was seeing appeared neurotic on their first interview, with intact reality testing. But when they were put on the couch, they got worse. Their lives unraveled and they became self-destructive as they were unable to grapple with the intense emotions the psychoanalysis brought up. Laying on the couch, unable to see the face of their psychoanalyst, didn't bring freedom. It brought paranoia.
20 years later, Otto Kernberg picked up on this idea that there are patients on the border between neurosis and psychosis who look like they might do better with psychoanalysis but actually get worse with the treatment, and he used it to modify the psychoanalytic technique to treat borderline personality. What he did was he put more structure into the therapy and swapped the couch for a chair so he could conduct the sessions face-to-face. This reduced the risk of unworkable psychotic transference. Fast forward to 2021, and we hear the same idea echoed by Loi Choi Kane as she described how to work with the intense emotions that come up with borderline clients.
When they feel like there's a real or perceived threat to that relationship and feeling so connected, that's when they become more hot, so to speak. They feel threatened in their stability because they need that other person. So they may become more angry, devaluing, and self-harming at that point in time. And that is where we would suggest that one leans into being more involved in working it out, even though that may be anti-intuitive, but doing it in a way that shows concern and investment in the stability of the relationship.
We are getting closer to a clarity around this mercurial disorder, but we are a long way from fully understanding it.
I went into psychiatry in part because it was so mysterious and hard to understand mental illness, and it still is 50 years later. But you know, it's an awful lot of fun. If I was working in a field where everything was cut and dry, I think I'd be bored. I only am sorry I won't live to see the answers to the big questions, but let's be honest with ourselves that we don't have those answers and we're just beginning.
Lois Choi Kahn is director of the Gundersen Personality Disorders Institute at McLean Hospital, Belmont, Massachusetts. Her 2019 APA textbook describes a practical approach to borderline personality disorder called good psychiatric management. Joel Paris is a professor emeritus at McGill University and senior psychiatrist and research associate at Sir Mortimer B. Davis Jewish General Hospital. He is the author of over 20 books, including 2020's Overdiagnosis in Psychiatry. And now for the word of the day, 5-HT2A.
Let's get this straight. 5-hydroxytryptamine is the scientific name for serotonin, and 5-HT is shorthand for 5-hydroxytryptamine. So when you see 5-HT, think serotonin. There are 7 families of serotonin receptors, from 5-HT1 to 5-HT7, and each family has a bunch of members labeled A, B, C, etc. You don't need to know them all, but you do need to know about this one, 5-HT2A. This receptor does 2 things in psychiatry. Activating it can cause psychosis, dissociation, and out-of-body experiences, which is why some antipsychotics like lumateperone, Caplyta, olanzapine, and clozapine block 5-HT2A. But there's another side to 5-HT2A. Activating it with an agonist can also raise empathy, openness, improve emotional processing, and possibly treat depression. Join us next week to learn about psilocybin, a 5-HT2A agonist that is undergoing phase 3 trials for FDA approval in depression.
Earn CME credits online and use the promo code PODCAST to get $30 off your first year subscription. That helps us stay in the ranks of Wikipedia, Kilometer Zero, Outdoor Indiana, and the select group of publications that do not accept commercial support.